Good morning. We see these elements on the table. We see the bread and we see the juice, the cup, and it reminds me of where we are as a church as we are studying through the story, that there's an upper story and there's a lower story. See, there's a lower story where a man is beaten and whipped and forced to walk along the road in Jerusalem carrying a cross, and he exits the city, and with some assistance, he takes that cross up to the hill outside the city, the hill of Golgotha, and on that cross, he's executed. And with him are two others that were executed. Now, this lower story, these events that are unfolding for people to see, is nothing shocking and nothing surprising to them. This is a normal occurrence for first century Judea. The Romans loved crucifixion. And I use that word on purpose. They did. They loved it. They loved the spectacle of it. They loved the anguish, the drama, the suffering. They loved the blood. They loved the whole pageantry of it. They used it extensively in the Colosseum, where they would have games where people would come together, and that's all. Lots and lots of people were crucified. This is something that was a part of their culture. It's this lower story. What is happening here? A man who claims to be God, he claims to be this Messiah that the Jewish people had spoken of for so long, and something happened. He really angered the officials, and now he's executed and he's dead. And then his body's taken down, and it's wrapped up, and spices are applied, and he's wrapped in cloth, and then he's placed into a tomb. That's the lower story, right? That's Mary weeping. That's Joseph of Arimathea coming and saying, "Oh, can I have the body, Pilate? I'll take care of it." And that's his disciples hiding in the upper room because they're freaked out. And the two guys walking on the road to Emmaus going, "Man, this has been a crazy week. Didn't turn out at all like we thought. We thought this was the one." See, the lower story plays out, but there's an upper story that we've celebrated this morning, right? There's an upper story because there's nothing gone amiss. There's nothing surprising or shocking to God, the Father. There's nothing shocking to Jesus, the Son. He prays for the Father's will to be done. He knows that this is going to be anguish for him to be crucified, but he knows he's here to do the Father's will, and he does it. See, the upper story is unfolding just as God intended it to. Genesis chapter 3, our very first chapter in the story, we saw that God's plan was these events, right? In fact, Ephesians tells us before the foundations of the earth were put into place, before our ancestors, before you and I were even created, before there was an Adam and an Eve, a man and a woman, this was God's upper story. This was his plan. You get it? See, there's a lower story, and that's what we're walking through. That's what we have recorded for us. But not just the lower story, the upper story is here for us too. And that's why we're walking through the story, that we're intentionally, week by week, I hope that you're meeting as families and you're leading your children and your teenagers through this, and our young people are looking at that in youth group, and our children are looking at it right now, because we as God's people, the church, need to understand what to do with all the events that are happening in our world and in our life. Come on, the lower story is confusing, is it not? When you see what's happening in around our world and in our neighborhoods and in our government and in our lives, it's confusing. You don't think the events of the crucifixion that week were confusing to those people? It absolutely was confusing to them and terrifying and shocking. This is not at all what we thought was going to happen. The lower story, the lives that we live are challenging. And if we don't understand the upper story, if we don't understand what God is doing in our lives, what God is doing in our midst, our lives aren't going to make any sense. See, the upper story gives us the lens to look through and understand the lower story. Last week, we left the people of Israel or at least a portion of them, coming back to Jerusalem. Man, what a story this has been so far, right? And it's going to just keep cranking up. It's going to get better and better. These people have been through so much, and they have just spent 70 years in captivity in Babylon, and now a large portion of them, about 50,000 of them, have come back. And they've begun, remember last week we saw they laid the foundation of the temple, and the beginning of the temple of being rebuilt is taking place. This morning, this chapter of the story is looking at the book of Esther. How many have read the book of Esther? Good job. The rest of you, shame on you. No. It's a great, great story. This morning, we have this narrative. We have this chapter in the life of God's people, the lower story, but a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful reminder of the upper story and what God is doing. We're going to see again that God, in His sovereignty, in His justice, in His mercy, and His commitment to His promises, is going to continue to write the story. So when we turn to the book of Esther, and I encourage you to do that, I asked if you'd read it because it's one of those ones that's hard to find. Now you're thinking, okay, where's Esther, right? Okay, I kind of know where the Psalms in the middle and, you know, the historical ones, and where's Esther? So we got Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. So Nehemiah's a little bigger, so if you open up and find Nehemiah, just go to the right a little bit and you're going to find Esther. And so Esther opens up verse 1 of chapter 1 that this is what happened. We're going to tell you a story of something that happened. These following events happened during the time of Xerxes, or Artaxerxes, or Ahasuerus. Depending on what translation you have, there's different names that are connected to this king. When did this happen? It happened probably between Ezra 6 and into Ezra 7. At the beginning of Ezra 7, we're told that now Xerxes is king. See, he's king of the Medes and the Persians. Remember the Babylonians? Remember Nebuchadnezzar and a couple of his sons and grandson? They're conquered. And the Medes and the Persians come together, and now they have a kingdom. After the Medes and the Persians, we're going to move into the Persian Empire. And anybody know the young leader of the Persian Empire eventually? We learn about him in school. His name was Alexander the Great. And then that moves into the Roman Empire. How do we know this? We know this because remember, God gave Daniel that dream. He gave the understanding of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And so this is when this is happening. This is happening when Xerxes is king over, it says, 127 provinces. He ruled a kingdom that stretched from what we know today as India. Let's see if you're looking at India's over here to the east and all the way over this way to the tip of Africa, Egypt. His empire was massive, and it was divided into 127 provinces. What do we know about Xerxes? We know that Xerxes was a very powerful man. We know that Xerxes, unlike our checks and balances in our government, he had absolute authority. We're going to see that this morning play out. He had all authority, and there was no one to question him. That he was ultimately powerful over the vast part of what we know to be civilization in his day. We also know that he loved to show off. He decided he was going to have a world's fair. You can read about it in chapter 1. He had a world's fair. It went for 180 days, and people were invited to travel from all over the kingdom to come to Susa and see the world's fair. And you know what the world's fair was? It was all these displays of how powerful and rich he was. All of his splendor was on display for 180 days. And then we're told that he's a partier. You thought that was a new term, huh? You thought that was, or at least, you know, me in the 70s, we thought that was a new term, the party girl, the party guy. He was a partier. He throws a party. And chapter 1 describes the party with two primary characteristics. The first one is that it lasted for 7 days. Can you imagine? I mean, we've had parties at our house, Super Bowl parties, you know, Christmas parties, birthday parties. 2.5, 3 hours into it, I'm done. You know, grandpa's ready for bed, you know, go home, clean up. Look at the mess, you know, the trash can's full, you know, it's, you know, party's over. 7 days this party rages. The other characteristic of this party is he gives his staff instructions. He says, serve the wine and keep serving the wine. And because this is a multicultural event, all the people that me and my ancestors, my predecessors have conquered, there's all these cultures, you just give what everybody wants, whatever they want, as much as they want. He says, you just give people the drink in the way that they want to and just keep serving the alcohol, keep serving the wine. So 7 days, this goes on. Well, 7 days into it, towards the end, he decides, I have no idea what state he's in, but can you kind of maybe imagine? Can you kind of maybe imagine what the party looks like and the people that are there, what's going on? He says, you know what? Guys, we've had 180 days of celebrating how great I am and all that I have and all that I've accomplished. I got one more. You haven't seen my wife, have you? You haven't seen my wife. I'm telling you, she is gorgeous. She is, just this party atmosphere. And he says, somebody go get her and bring her in here. Parade her around for everybody to see. I heard that. The women are going, ugh. The men are going, ugh. Bring her in and just bring her out here and let everybody see how beautiful she is. The Queen Vashti gets the message, and her response is probably what you'd expect. It's what? No way. I've heard the music. I've heard the ruckus. I've, you know, heard what's been going on in there for 7 days. There's no way I'm going in there. And so she says no. And we learn something else about Xerxes, that he doesn't like the word no. He's actually a 2-year-old, right? He doesn't like the word no. And we learn then that he's also an angry man. He has a temper. He has an issue with anger. It says he burned with rage. He was furious that his wife wouldn't do what he told her to do. And then we discover that Xerxes is a man who likes to have people around him to do this. Yeah, tell him what he likes to hear. And so his advisors come and he says, what should we do? And they say, you know, this is a terrible thing that's happened. Terrible thing that your queen said no to you. You know what? This is going to spread. This is going to spread. In fact, this is going to get throughout, the word's going to go throughout the whole kingdom. And wives everywhere are going to rise up and say no to their husbands. And it's going to cause chaos in our civilization, in our culture here. We've got to do something. So issue a decree, write a law that says women everywhere have to behave a certain way. And get rid of Vashti. Take away her royal position and give it to someone else. And Xerxes does what to his wife? He throws her under the bus, doesn't he? He likes it, he says. It tells you can read all this in chapter 1 of Esther, that he likes their counsel, and so he does exactly that. Do you like Xerxes? No? Gets better. Chapter 2, verse 1, later when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he had calmed down. He remembered Vashti. He remembered what she had done and what he had decreed about her. So he's in a, shall we say, he's in a feeling sorry for himself stage. Quite a guy, huh? Quite a role model. He's feeling sorry for himself and he's thinking about what's happened and what he did and maybe he misses Vashti a little bit, I don't know, but he's just in that kind of that place, and his council around him observes that, they see it, and so in verse 2, the king's personal attendants say, hey, we have an idea, King Xerxes, we have an idea, we have a proposal, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province, all 127 provinces of his realm, to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel, the palace of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And this advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, we need to hover here not too long, but we do need to hover here for a second to try to capture what's happening in the kingdom. You got kind of a picture of what's happening? Oh, king, you're sad and you feel bad and you're lonely and we have an idea. Let's send out commissioners. Let's let them go throughout all the land. Let's find all the beautiful unmarried young women that are just beautiful. Let's bring them all here, and then we'll give them a season where they can just really, you know, prepare themselves, and they will be there for you, and then you'll work your way through them, and you'll pick one of them to be your king or your queen. This is the setting for the book of Esther. This is what's happening. As you think about, you know, Brian Williams being suspended for 6 months and things like that that are happening, you know, these things that are happening in our world. Do you even know what I'm talking about? Something, okay. So, you know, we interpret the stuff that's happening, and it kind of creates a flavor, a feel for a year or a month or a time, right? Are you following me? You know, the events of our world and our community kind of set the feel for what's happening and what life feels like in any given moment. This is the setting for Esther, that this decree has gone out and these events are happening and families are being torn apart. People are, you know, knocking on the door, and I understand you have a daughter and she's very beautiful. Here she is. Yes, she is. Come on, she's gone. She's ours. We're taking her. What? Yeah, she's going to the palace. Are you feeling what's happening here? This is the setting for Esther. The events that unfold following take place within this setting. In chapter 2, verse 5, we're introduced to the next character in this story. We've met Xerxes, and now we meet a guy named Mordecai. There was in the citadel, in the palace of Susa, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. So here's Mordecai. Mordecai is a Jewish man. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. He's in Babylon, or he's in this part of the world, in Susa, because he was part of the exile. He'd been carried away. And now he was serving in some way in Susa. In verse 7, the following verse, we're introduced to the third character, and that's Esther. We've met Xerxes, we've met Mordecai, now we're introduced to Esther. Verse 7. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features. Form meaning her physical appearance, features meaning her face. And Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken. Esther also was taken. If you mark in your Bible, if you make notes, that's a word to underline. That will help us understand the times that Esther is living in. Esther was, say it, Esther was taken. This is not a voluntary event. This is not a beauty contest. Anybody who wants to pay the fee and enter, come on in. No, this is against your will, whether you like it or not. She was taken. Esther also was taken to the king's palace, and she was entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. He gave her special treatment. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background. She hadn't told anybody that she was a Jew. Why? It tells us Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. So we meet Esther. She's a beautiful young lady. We already have a little bit of a hint of her character. She's moved into this chaotic life, turning upside down. I know that's not even a correct way to say it, but a turning upside down life event. How's that? Her life is completely uprooted and turned upside down. She's taken away from her guardian, from Mordecai, and she's placed in this strange place with all these other young ladies. And we see right away that she kind of distinguishes herself. And the eunuch in charge of this part of the harem notices, and he gives her special treatment. We're given a little bit of a glimpse into what kind of young lady she is. Well, the process unfolds. The king begins to work his way through the harem. And it's described a little bit for us here in chapter 2, verse 12. Before a girl's turn came to go to the king Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatment. So there's a process. And it was prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem to the care of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. See, now you're a concubine. Now you belong to the king. You're property of the king. And there's a separate palace where you live, and you stay there the rest of your life. And any interaction you would have beyond that with the king who you belong to would only happen if the king asked for you specifically. What a life. Seriously, what a life. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Wow. This young girl, this young Jewish girl living in Susa, lost her parents. Her older cousin Mordecai had adopted her and taken her in and was raising her as his daughter, had been caught up in this edict and was taken to the palace and experienced this year of process and all that went on, and her night came. I have a hard time fully grasping, maybe all of us will, of what that was like, that moment, that evening, that call. Esther, it's your turn tonight. And she goes in, and he's attracted to her. He's attracted to her beauty, but he's also taken with her character. He's taken with her character. Another glimpse of who this young lady really is. And he chooses her. And he takes the crown, and he puts it on her head. And now Esther, the young Jewish girl, is queen of the Medo-Persian Empire and all that comes with it. They should make a movie about this. They did, yes, they did, that's right. Several, actually, yes. She becomes queen of the Medes and the Persian. Persian Empire. In chapter 3, verse 5, we're introduced to the next character. Now, you say, wait a minute, you're kind of jumping over some stuff. Yeah, I am jumping over some stuff, but you're going to read it this week in the story, right? Right? And you're going to meet as families or as couples or just by yourself with God, and you're going to read through the story, right? Right. And if you don't have a copy of the story, where can you get one? You can get it right back here at the information booth. It's free of charge. We have a copy for you because we want you to read through this. Because I am skipping over. If you came this morning thinking I'm going to teach through the book of Esther, you don't know me. So we'll all be reading the story this week. So in chapter 3, verse 5, we're introduced to the next character, and his name is Haman. It says, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, the Jewish people, he scorned the idea. He rejected the idea of killing only Mordecai. Whoa, wait a minute. He wanted to kill Mordecai? Yes, but not only Mordecai, he wanted to kill all the Jewish people because Mordecai was a part of them. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the entire kingdom of Xerxes. So who is this Haman guy? Well, Haman is a descendant of Agag the king. He's an Amalekite. Remember in the story, we've met the Amalekites. The Amalekites were the people that God told King Saul to completely destroy. You remember that? He said, I want you to go, I want you to completely wipe out this people. I'm like, wait. For 2015 or 14, when we looked at this, 2014, we looked at this and we thought, wait, really? Really? Just a complete, that's called genocide. completely wipe out a group of people. God said, Saul, wipe out that group of people. Why did God say wipe out the Amalekites? We're reminded in Deuteronomy who the Amalekites are. Who are the Amalekites? The Amalekites are these people that when Israel came out of Egypt and were making their way to the Promised Land, and there are 1.5 to 3 million people somewhere in that range, and they're marching, this large group of people. The Amalekites were the upstanding people that waited at the rear of that long line, and as old people and children, the people that walk slowest, they systematically, they just waited at the tail of this long and just were picking off the people, the weak, the old, the ones that couldn't keep up. And God is a loving God. He's a gracious God. But never forget that God is a just God, and He's a holy God. And God judged that group of people. That was His plan through King Saul. Well, Haman is a descendant. He's an Agagite, an Amalekite. He's a descendant of these people. And it goes for generations and generations and generations that you think the Amalekites liked the Jewish people after King Saul conquered them, at least partially? Absolutely not. That's who Haman is. He's a conquered people. He's a part of this empire, and he's in the service of the king. And he's honored. He's given a place of honor. And he's told that he can proclaim that everybody in his presence should bow down to him. So whenever he walks around, everybody bows down. Wouldn't that be weird? Seriously, that would be so... No, please, please, Amy, no, please get down, please. Okay, a few more seconds. Okay, now get up. Okay, good. You know, it would be strange, wouldn't it? Everybody's, oh, they're bowing to you. Unless you're Japanese, then you're used to it, right? You know, but they just bow to him all the time, and they're just doing this. But there's one person that won't do it. Mordecai the Jew, the descendant of actually Benjamin, Kish, which is the same tribe that Saul is from, won't bow to the Amalekite. And it infuriates Haman. It infuriates him. In fact, he says, I really want to kill Mordecai, but I don't want to just kill Mordecai. I want to kill all of the Jews. I want to get rid of all of these people that worship this Jehovah in Jerusalem. I want to get rid of all of them. So he goes to the king. He goes to Xerxes and he says, Xerxes, I have a plan. There's a group of people that really are a problem in your kingdom and I want to get rid of them. Can I get rid of them? Can we have a day? Can we have a holiday? I know like President's Day or like Labor Day, Memorial Day. Can we have a Memorial Day? And on that day, can we give everybody in your kingdom a pass? And in that pass, they can kill any Jewish people they want to kill, and they can take all their stuff. Could we have a day like that? And Xerxes, being Xerxes, says, sure, absolutely. So guess what Haman does? Haman does this. Let's do it on that day. Let's do it on the 13th day of Adar, the last month in the Jewish calendar. You see, he takes the pur, P-U-R, the pur, which is dice, the lot, and he just does that. And when the casting of the lot, when the roll of the dice, a day is picked that all the Jewish people in the kingdom would be killed, and everybody had the freedom to do it. If you have neighbors that are Jewish, you like their house, kill them, take their house. You see that family over there, the Jewish family, you like their car, kill them and take their car. Kill them all. Kill them all. Kill them all. That's the plan. And it's put into place, it's endorsed by the king, a decree is made. And in chapter 3, verse 13, when Haman saw that Mordecai, verse 13, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy. If you think I'm exaggerating, listen to this. Kill, destroy, annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods, take everything they have. A copy of the text of the edict, the king's command, was to be issued as law. It's endorsed. The police are going to stand by. The military is going to stand by. Nobody's going to stop you. You're not going to go to jail. Normally, this is wrong. But for one day, you can do this and take whatever you want. And it goes out. The law is proclaimed. Can you imagine the evening news? You know, Brian Williams gets on there. Says, after I got out of that helicopter. No, just kidding. If you don't know what that story is, see me afterwards. He says, reported tonight by King Xerxes that on the 13th day of Adar, the Jewish people are free game. You can kill them, you can kill their families, you can take whatever you want. There won't be any repercussions. The police will not arrest you. You're free to do whatever you want on the 13th day of Adar. This becomes law. A copy of the text is sent out and issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers go. They send it out the rule. The edict was issued on the citadel of Susa, and the king and Haman sit down to have a drink. But the city of Susa was in confusion. The people outside of that circle were like, what? What are you talking about? But the king and Haman, they sit down and they have a drink. Cheers. Are you getting the picture? Are you getting the picture of what's happening in the backdrop of what God is about to do? Mordecai hears of the plan and he sends word to Esther. And in chapter 4, verse 9, let me introduce you to the real Esther. She's beautiful. We've seen some glimpses into her character. But let me introduce you to the real Esther, the Esther that I want you to know and to love. Hathach went back, a messenger, and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. This plan that's unfolding, this is going to happen on the 13th day of Adar. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. See, Mordecai had said, Esther, you need to go to the king and you need to stop this. She says, Mordecai, do you understand what the law is here? If I'm not summoned and I go to him without him asking me to come, there's just one rule, there's one outcome. You die. I love this Xerxes guy. You know, man, what a ruler. You get put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend his gold scepter. He could choose to do that to the person and spare their life. But Mordecai, 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. I haven't seen him for a month. He hasn't called me. I haven't had no contact with him. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this message. Esther, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, catch this, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. Now don't miss that, because now we're getting a glimpse into the heart of Mordecai, the faith of Mordecai, the belief, the confidence that Mordecai has in Jehovah and his covenant promise to his people. God will not fail to protect us. If you don't step up and do it, God will do it some other way. However, you and your father's family will perish. And who knows that you have come to the royal position. Maybe all this craziness that's happened to you and what's you're the queen now and all that you had to go through for that year and all this has gone on. Maybe all of this has purpose. Maybe God has designed this for such a time as this. What has been confusing, what has been scary, what has made no sense at all, what has completely turned upside down your plans as a young lady and how you wanted your life to go and what you envisioned it to be, that was all lost, maybe. It was because God designed it and he's placed you exactly where he wants you to be for this moment. Guess what? Mordecai understands the upper story. He doesn't have the story in a book form, but he gets the heart of God. He understands God's commitment, his covenant to his people. Then Esther sent this reply. So we see Mordecai for who he is. Check out Esther. Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Fast and pray is what she's asking for. Stop eating and pray for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will do the same. We'll fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king. Even though it is against the law, I will go to the king. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai, I'll go to the king. That is the real Esther. That's the Esther that young ladies should emulate and look towards and say, I want to be like that. That's the message our young girls need to hear. Amen? It's not the message they're hearing from our culture, is it? They're hearing the Xerxes message, right? What counts is that you're beautiful in your face and your feminine elements for the king. The message our young ladies need to hear is that Esther is your role model. Esther, who is willing to sacrifice her life, if need be, to serve others, to save God's people. Not knowing what the outcome will be, I'll do it. And so she does. She goes to the king and she asks him for, well, she goes into the king and she waits and he sticks out his scepter and she comes and she touches it. And he says, what can I do for you? And she says, I want to have a dinner for you and Haman. Just you and Haman. And the king says, great. And Haman goes, yes, 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 yes. And he goes home and he says, you cannot believe this. There's a dinner and it's just me and the king. Just me and the king and the queen. That's all she invited. And it's so awesome. Except Mordecai. He will not bow down to me. I saw him again today and he won't bow down. And the wife says, and here's not who you should emulate, wives. Why don't you build a really tall gallows? Just build a big thing and hang him on it. Hey! High fives. Thank you, wife. I knew there was a reason I loved you. And so he does. He builds this gallows, this 75-foot tall gallows, with the intent to hang Mordecai on it. So in chapter 7, verse 1, we come to the banquet. The king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and as they were drinking wine on that second day, the king again asked Queen Esther, what is your petition? What do you want? It'll be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. It'll be granted. Then Queen Esther answered the king, if I have found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. This is what I ask for. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, if we had just been sold into slavery, I would have kept my mouth shut. I would have kept quiet because no such distress. That's not worthy, that situation, to disturb the king. I wouldn't even have brought that to you if it was just we were sold into slavery. King Xerxes, I think he's a little bit confused, asked Queen Esther, who is he? What are you talking about? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? And Esther said, the adversary and the enemy is him, this vile Haman. Now, we talk sometimes about wanting to see video in heaven, and usually it's kind of fun stuff. If you want a glimpse into the real me, here you go. I want to see this. I want to see his face. I want to see that look on his face when she points at him, and he's going from, you know, me and the king and the queen, you know, I'm the only one, I'm the favorite, you know, and this food is awesome, and, you know, and all of a sudden, Haman is the one that's threatening my life, king. This vile Haman is the one who is doing it. Then Haman was terrified. He was out of his mind scared before the king and the queen. The king got up in a rage and he left his wine and he went out to the palace garden. He went for a walk to process. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, I'm a dead man. He stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. And just as the king was returning from his walk, he comes back from the palace garden to the banquet hall. Haman has fallen on the couch where Esther is reclining. He's begging her for his life. He's fallen next to her. Please, please, don't let the king kill me. And the king says, will he even molest the queen while she was with me in the house? And as soon as he said those words, there was no further instructions that were needed for the guards. They knew exactly what needed to happen. And they approached Haman. They took a sack, a bag, and they covered his face. Because the rule is when the king was displeased with someone, no one would ever look on them again. And he's covered and he's taken out. As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered his face. And the Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, see, the truth is there's a lot of people who didn't like Haman. And now they're kind of coming out of the woodwork, and this guy's like, you know what? Here's my opportunity. Hey, this guy built a gallows 75 feet high. His intent was that he was going to have Mordecai killed. Remember who Mordecai is? Look at the end there, verse 9. He's the one who spoke up to help the king. And Haman wanted to kill him. The king said, hang him on it. Take him out and hang him. And the king's fury subsided. The enemy is gone. Haman is taken care of. God has taken care of his people again. But we got a problem. You see, the rule is when a king makes a law, it can't be undone. So the law still stands. The 13th of Adar is still going to happen. So they come to the king and say, well, can you do this? Can you issue a new decree that says people can defend themselves against this law? Can the Jewish people defend themselves and fight against those who are coming to annihilate them? And the king says, yeah, I'll do that. And in chapter 8, the king issues this decree. There's one verse that's interesting, and my time is gone. I'm going to wrap this up. But verse 17, look at the end of chapter 8. It says, many people of other nationalities became Jews. Many people of other nationalities became Jews because the fear of the Jews had seized them. And so on that day, when the Jews were given permission to defend themselves, a lot of other nationalities said, hey, we're Jews too. We follow Jehovah. We're on your side. And in chapter 9, we're given this feast, this celebration called Purim. All Purim is, it's the plural. It's not a Hebrew word. It's a Persian word, but it's the plural of pur, of lot, of dice. And they celebrate. They celebrate God's miraculous deliverance of his people. You see, the enemy of God is trying to destroy God's upper story. He's trying to destroy the plan. Satan wants the people of God annihilated, and God steps in again. And as he has done many times, and as he will do many more times because of his covenant promise, he protects them. Let me close with these two thoughts. God, and it's in your notes, God is always faithful to preserve a remnant to fulfill his covenant promises. He always preserves a remnant. The second thought is this: God is always looking for one he can use to fulfill that covenant promise. God is always looking for an Esther. He's always looking for a King David. 1 Samuel 16:9, the Lord looks at the heart. A man after his own heart. 2 Chronicles 16. The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth, and they're looking to strengthen the hearts of those who are fully committed to him. And the context of that verse is a young man, a young king, who had trusted God early in his life and now failed to. And God says, I'm always looking for the one that I can work through and use in a really dark, tough spot. One that I can use to fulfill my covenant promise. God's committed. He's faithful to his promise. The question is, am I? Am I willing to be that one in the place that he has put me? Am I willing to be an Esther for such a time as this? Let's pray together. Father, I thank you for the truth of your word. It is your word. This is your story that you're writing. God, I pray that our hearts would be drawn to you this morning, that we would see in Esther what it looks like to be God's man, God's woman, God's young person in the moment, in the place that you've put us, that we might be a part of what you're doing in this world today. In Jesus' name, amen.